So welcome, Jackie. Very
Thank
nice
you.
To meet you properly. So we always start poetry by asking, do you want to come and sit at the front so you can see a bit better?
Does anybody else want to switch around for you?
Yeah. <You're all moving. laughs> So we always start by asking the poet why they chose the poem. So firstly, why did you, just say a little bit about why you chose the Robert Burns. I was particularly noticing the dialect in your collection, Fear.
Yeah, well, Robert Burns is just one of my favourite poets of all time. I grew up going to Burns suppers, and I used to just really love the drama that was involved in the Burns supper, particularly the address to the haggis, and the idea that the haggis could have its own poem. One of the few items of food that has its own poem, if you think about it, really. I like that, and the knife, you know, bursting into the haggis and the haggis bursting open. But John Addison, My Jo John, I particularly like because it's tender, and in the course of these two stanzas that Parmi read so beautifully, you get the course of a long relationship from really the beginning to the end, and even beyond the end into their death. Now we mun totter down, John, and hand in hand we go, and sleep together at the foot, John Addison, My Jo. And Jo is the old Scots word for friend, so it's the same word as fear. Or fee, as I pronounce it. So I love the idea that a relationship, which is presumably a romantic relationship, is also a friendship in that poem, and that she's seen him go from young to old, from having fine hair to being belled, as she said. I noticed she did hand movements there, apparently, to help people out in case she knew what was going on. So yes, I think Burns is one of the most tender love poets, and I love the idea that these poems are still so current. I wanted to write them in Fear. The title poem of this new collection is really a response to that poem, only it takes the course of a friendship between two women over the course of their whole lifetime.
And the Edwin Morgan?
Well, Edwin Morgan was the Scots Macker up until very recently when he died, just over a year ago, and he was really an extraordinary extraordinary man. He came out as gay when he was in his 70s, and that particular poem, Strawberries, is actually about a man's love poem to another man, but you don't necessarily know that. And all of his early love poems had to be reassessed once people found out he was gay. And they found them sort of peculiarly genderless within these poems themselves. So there was these clues that if you were reading carefully enough, you would have been able to see. So I particularly like that. I like the Kilpatrick Hills in that poem. I like the last line. It's a sort of that you also read really beautifully about let the storm wash the place. I was interested in the way that you read that line, because you read that line coming down rather than let the storm wash the place. It was sort of a gentleness, which I thought was really, really nice. It showed me how many different interpretations there are to that. And also, it's quite a difficult poem to read, that poem, because it doesn't punctuate it, and the lines really leave it open for you to interpret how you want. Did you find it? That's.
And in your latest collection, Fear, you've got a poem, Strawberry Meringue, about your visit with your mother to Edwin Morgan, is that right?
That's right, yes. I went to visit him in his old people's home with my mum and took some strawberry meringues. He had a great sweet tooth. I quite like the idea of, you know, a serious poet having a sweet tooth. Actually, it turned out that Edwin Morgan, you know, when he died recently, they found that he was a millionaire, and he'd left behind an estate of £2.3 million, which was quite really, really surprising, and he'd been betting in the stock exchange, so he wasn't just a closet gay, he was a secret millionaire. That's kind of made me have to reassess him slightly.
Any other secret millionaires in the audience? So let's move on a little bit to your life. I've got so many questions I'd like to ask you. You know, obviously I've been reading Red Dust Road, and I was very, very struck, amongst many things, about the portrait of your parents. They really come over as remarkable people. They make your way of writing about them really makes me want to meet them. I just wondered whether you might introduce us to your parents. I don't know why, but I felt introduced to them in the book.
Well, they are really wonderful people. I mean, their names are John and Helen, and they're really, I often do feel quite fated to have been with them, because they really are remarkable people. And people that read Red Dust Road and that know them often feel like they've actually been in their company. Because I was quite interested in the book and trying to get their syntax right and get their speech patterns and rhythm. So if you have met them, you know, you'll know. Even they have to admit it's them. Like my dad came to a reading that I did not that long ago in Melrose in the south of Scotland, and the interviewer suddenly turned the microphone on him, and which alarmed me somewhat, and said, how does it feel to be written about? And he said, well, I mean, obviously I was proud of the book, but you're reading it and you're thinking, that's not me, oh Christ, that is me.
There's so many, as I say, questions I've got, but the other thing that really struck me reading Red Dust Road was what I call semi-chapters. What were you saying that you call them?
Interludes.
Interludes,
I think of them as little pauses, I suppose, a bit like that meditation that we just did, the four-minute meditation, as opposed to your big, long metabhavana or something. It's in that little space of time, you get a breather, really, between one chunky chapter and another, and a chance to reflect. Also, I was worried about, because the book moves back and forth in time, and and these little interludes provide a chronology of sorts. So there's a kind of they follow some sort of pattern. So as if you had lost your way in time, which doesn't seem to have happened to people, if you had lost your way, then there would be a little map in these kind of interludes, and they're more poetic. I mean, some of them are like kind of prose poems.
Yes, that's right.
So I like the idea of them existing in form as well, in between the narrative.
I was really struck by the first one. I was struck by them all, but the one 1969 that you just titled 19. I wonder whether you'd like to tell us that story. It's such a striking story.
Well, I was going to read that later.
Let's save that for later. First, the other question I wanted to ask is how poetry came into your life, both reading it and writing it. In the book, you talk of an accident, but I just wondered how poetry entered your life. It seemed to enter your life. Writing entered your life very dramatically, really.
Yeah, well, I was really lucky in the sense of this mum and dad, John and Helen, really liked poetry, and it's quite unusual. Amongst my poet friends, not many of them had parents that also liked poetry, and I used to get taken to these poem and pints nights at the Highland Institute in Stucky Hall Street in Glasgow. I must say, more pints than poetry. And so I used to get going to these, and going to Burns suppers. My mum read poems to me out loud. So I did grow up in a house that liked poems and that liked literature, and that was quite lucky. Even though they're working class people and they were never gone to further education, so it wasn't a kind of wasn't an English degree kind of thing. It was just an interest and a sharing of poems. And my dad was in a mountaineering group, and these men all in this mountaineering group used to read poems to each other at the top of the mountain, which I quite like. I didn't have to climb the mountain to like the poems. And then I did have a very serious motorbike accident when I was 17, and I had a compound tibia and fibula, and the bone came right out of my leg, and it was all quite dramatic, and I hit three cars all in all, and I actually thought I had died, you know, that strange way. Well, I'm saying you know that way. Of course you know that way. You all know that way, don't you? And you fly over the top, and I landed outside, and I flew over the top of the third car, and I landed outside this graveyard, and my mum said, "We could have just thrown you over the wall." But after that, I spent quite a long time, because it was about a year and a half before I walked properly again, and I had been a very keen runner, and before that I was this kind of Scottish go-go champion. So then I just spent really a lot of time reading and writing, and I think that really made me that accident. You know, I think accidents, if you can survive them, you know, there can be something positive of them. There certainly was in that accident for me, even having the walking stick for 6 months and the plastic splint for 6 months and a year and a half before I walked anyway. Even that taught me quite a lot, because it taught me of how the world is really geared towards able-bodied people, and how every building that you go into is geared, and just getting off a bus and all of these things at quite an early age. So that made me interested in poetry and writing.
I also wonder whether it was to do with there's lovely stories in the Red Dress Road about your father's incredible capacity for songs, and you could just say a word, couldn't you, and it's come up with a song that fitted the word. I wondered whether, do you think that might be one of the roots of poetry for you?
Yeah, I think music as well is one of the biggest influences in my life, apart from literature and people, just because just the rhythms of music I've just always been interested in, whether it's blues music or jazz music or classical music. I've been really, I'm not really particularly musical myself, and I can't sing. and I can't play a musical instrument, but I think I'm sort of musical in other ways, in the sense of being able to hear it. And I certainly grew up around lots of sing songs, and I used to never be happier than when a group of people were just collected in a room like this, or perhaps a bit smaller, where people would just be singing their song, and everybody had their song, and I used to love it, you know, and Anna Ashton would sing A Fond Kiss, and just I used to associate different people with also their songs that they sang, and everybody would shout. My dad would be up and down the living room going, "One singer, one song!" And everybody, you know, the whole thing would turn into kind of quite a lively thing. And, you know, it was like Peter Morton, and he would sing in an American accent. So he would sing, "Put your sweet lips a little closer." And his chin would judder at the last line, you know, "Floor, bone." And so I really liked when, you know, even as a wee girl, watching these sort of weird things and tics that people had when they were singing, whether they clapped or whether they moved their chins in and out, and all the kind of strange ways that people had of dramatising themselves and almost of making themselves slightly filmic or slightly theatrical. So I've always really loved that about music, that you can just within a second, and also the tip provides a kind of a chronology of your life, that if you listen to certain pieces of music, you're immediately taken back to falling in love this time, or falling out of love that time, or, you know, that it just takes you on a journey.
I also wanted to kind of ask you about speech patterns, because I was very struck reading the selected poems, very struck reading all of your work, that you, and well, as Fiona Sampson said in a review of Darling, New and Selected Poems, she says that you have an immaculate ear for speech patterns. And I thought that was really true, and I wondered whether you could say a little bit more about your instinct for speech patterns and characters. It's almost what it slightly reminded me of is the shows you did as a child, because I've read the book, so I know you did shows. whether it came from that, or a sense of drama that's there in the work?
I don't know. I don't really know where it comes from, but I just really do, and I still do, like listening to the ways that people talk and the rhythms, and how, you know, we all have particular expressions that we use repeatedly, or and even safe expressions that we return to again and again. I mean, sometimes aware of them and sometimes not aware of them, but we all have the kind of pins in our speech patterns, and that fascinates me. And growing up in Scotland was a great place for speech patterns, isn't it, Valerie? Because you'd have things like, my mum would say things like, "I'm not tired, but I'm tired." "I'm not hungry, but I'm hungry." You're supposed to know exactly the nth degree. And then my gran, you know, she came from Lochgelly, and she had a whole turn of phrase altogether. So when Ian McEwan was shortlisted for the Booker the second time around, she said to me, "Ah, wee old jockey, the fat sow's arse is always greased." I've never really worked that one. But I really like, you know, the colourfulness of people's of expressions. And I do have an ability to listen to a whole conversation and remember the entire conversation, just, you know, in kind of almost kind of creepy detail, which kind of freaks my family out quite a lot. But I will be able to sort of remember what's happened when and what people have said, just because it's kind of, I suppose, it's one of the things that you do when you're a writer, is that it's your job, really, is to try and create characters, voices, authentic voices. And to me, that work only matters, or it's only any good if the voice of the character is authentic. If you can actually believe it, it could be somebody that was telling you a story at a bus stop, or somebody who had something urgent that they really wanted to say to you. And if it sounds like it's creative writing, then, you know, forget it. So you've got to go through a lot of trouble to kind of disguise the fact that what you're actually doing is making things up.
And that's true of the poems and the memoirs. And I was wondering, you know, you've written novels, you've written short stories, you've written poems, you've written a memoir. What do you feel the form you're most drawn to? Are you drawn?
I don't know. I mean, I think I'm probably jack of all trades and master of none. But right, I really like writing short stories. I think I'm probably most comfortable with that form, just because it kind of exists halfway between a poem and a novel. It shares enough about poetry. It shares enough from poetry for the precision of language, but it shares from the novel the kind of narrative sweep, and I like creating those characters. But I really like writing poems too. So the thing I don't like writing is novels, and that's why I've only written one. And I am writing another novel at the moment. But, you know, it just takes you've got to hole yourself up in an attic or a cellar for a number of years, and it doesn't really come naturally to me, the business of writing a longer narrative, even though people that like Trumpet are always asking me, you know, when am I going to write another novel? And to me, it's actually just important to write the thing that you're in at the moment, you know, so so not really not really to pressurise yourself about writing a particular form, but to write the form that's coming to you through the idea, and the idea comes with the form to me, so there's never really any debate about what form should, something should be. The idea and the form are already kind of like that, like that, for the people at the back.
Because there's a sense of that which, you know, reading, I'm very struck reading the memoir alongside the poems, how much you can move from one, from a prose piece to a poem. So for instance, I was, you know, obviously very struck by your chapter called Reality Britain in Redruth Road, very, very moving, rather painful account of racism. And then you read a short poem like In My Country. They sit together and they do different things. Yeah, I'd just be interested to hear more. I particularly wonder whether you'd like to say a little bit about that chapter. I mean, how was that to write that chapter, and a little bit about your experience of that?
Well, it's interesting you should ask about that, my Chia Bandhu. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
I've got to have done that. Crossed that bridge.
Has that hurt? Don't need to do it again.
I can do it now because I've got the tray in the right place. Yeah. I can just imagine you bringing me a little cup of tea. And then
my niece remembered it by my chair abandoned.
My tray abandoned, because he brought me this peppermint tea with the honey, so that was nice. So yeah, my tray abandoned. I still have to get my friend up the back there, who has got a new name, Bodhi Lilya. I'll have to get that right, but I'll get that right eventually. But the question, Reality Britain. Well, Reality Britain's probably, I read this entire book recently. I read Dust Road for the audiobook, which is just out now. So the whole unabridged book is out with all of me reading it. And it's the second time that I've read it, because I also read it for the blind. And I found the chapter Reality Britain the hardest chapter to read, and the most exposing in a strange way, even though the chapter is all about racism, and it's all about my experiences of racism in Britain growing up, from being a young kid really right through to being an adult. But I found it was the most embarrassing chapter to read, because there's a sound technician in there listening to you and not necessarily reacting to... The first time I read it at the blind for the RNIB, they didn't. I think the woman was just embarrassed. Really, she was a white woman, Glaswegian, and I think she was just embarrassed. Not the Glaswegians aren't necessarily the best people to talk about racism with. But the next time I read it was in London, and it was a white man again, but he actually said, bloody scandal, isn't it? Just awful when we had our tea break, and that made it all so much better. But there is something about racism whenever you confront it, or whenever you've had to confront it, that is always just kind of takes your breath away. I never exactly am prepared for it, and I'm always surprised by it. And there isn't ever any clever or bright response that you can have right away. You can never think of the right thing to say, and afterwards you go back and you think, oh, I should have said this, or I should have said that. And for some reason you're always finding yourself wanting, you know, lacking in your response, but actually, of course, it's got nothing to do with you. It's got to do with the response of the people who are being racist. But it is just a very, very interesting thing, and that chapter really explores all different kinds of racism, from the very, very overt... Me, you know, I was actually beaten up by, you know, fascists at the Angel Tube station in London. Actually physically beaten up, and physically beaten up as a kid. So it explores that kind of really strong, violent racism through to the kind of innocuous racism where somebody doesn't actually even realise necessarily that they're being racist, that happens all the time, and where they presumably would mean no harm, but the kind of the accumulation of these small acts of racism. Changes your sense of yourself.
I mean, I was struck that some of them were really quite chilling. There's one of when you're a child, where children are being racist, then an adult joins in a certain sense. Very, very sort of chilling moment.
Yeah, I think adults being racist, I mean, I think as a kid, you sort of think, well, kids are all, they're calling you names, they're calling other people names, so you deal with it in some sort of way. But I think when adults are racist, then that's kind of quite really deeply shocking.
Especially to a child.
Yeah, I mean, when I was attacked at the Angel Tube station, there was some fascists, you know, that were breaking bottles, and the British Movement, you know, T-shirts on and breaking bottles. And then I turned to these businessmen that were standing right there, and I said, aren't you going to do anything? And they said, no, we support them. And that was really, really, really chilling. I mean, that stayed with me. I was sort of 19 at the time, but that has completely stayed with me for my entire life, and has also made me look at people in quite a different way, that you can't just look at people and think, oh, that's the identifiable racist.
Mm. Mm.
Moving swiftly on.
Yeah. I want to start talking a little bit about the poems. Your collection at the Adoption Papers caused quite a stir, didn't it, when it was published in 1991, and it follows the story of your adoption from three different points of view. I wanted to ask you what gave you the idea to write it in three different voices, and how did you feel about the book's reception?
Well, I had a lot of trouble getting it. You've really done your homework. It's amazing. Very impressive. I feel we should really be huddled in a room on our own.
I did say you didn't have to answer the question.
It's getting quite embarrassing.
You went to it.
I'm not sure if it caused a stir, but I think it was. I think it got quite a much, much better response than I'd ever imagined it to get, and it got an even better response than even the. The publishers imagined it to get. I remember the publisher because it sold out. The first print run, poetry runs are always quite modest anyway, but the first print run of whatever, 4,000 copies, sold out within 6 months, which was quite a lot of books to sell then in 6 months of poems. And the publisher phoned me and said, oh, we're getting quite a response to this book. I'm going to have to go back and read it again. So not even he expected it would sell very well. And I did have to sort of type that book around for quite a while before I ever found a publisher who would accept it. But the book came about just simply because I was attending a Caribbean literature conference way back in 1985. And they had this spot, you know, one of these spots where you could just get up and read a poem. And so I got up and I read these two poems, Mother Poem 1 and Mother Poem 2, that's what I called them, rather imaginatively. And they got such an amazing response. There was about 300 people there. It was the first time I'd ever read any of my work out loud to a larger audience than my friends from school. And they got such an amazing response. Everybody was coming up and asking where they could get them, and they weren't published. And then I thought, actually, these poems could probably, if they're getting that kind of response, could probably write some more of them. So I did. So they became the Adoption Papers, and then I decided to meld the voices together. So because they were on the radio originally, they were a radio play, and for that radio play, I had to make the voices more interactive. And then, because the voices were counterpointing each other like a piece of music, it was to be hoped. Then I left it like that because I just thought it was nicer to have these voices. So it was just really quite organic and took quite a long time between the initial writing of these two poems to the final publication. It was probably about 6 years.
I mean, it's striking because I was reading Red Distro, then I went back to reading Adoption Papers. And again, this resonance between the two. And again, I feel that a bit in Fear, the resonance between Red Dust Road and Fear. At times it feels like they're a companion volume. I don't know whether did you imagine them like that?
Yeah, no, I definitely did. I definitely wanted Fear to be a companion volume to Red Dust Road, just because when I was going to Nigeria and finding my birth father, lots of things happened to me on that journey that weren't part of the prose. They were poems. And so I wrote poems alongside the journey. And I just really liked the idea of one book being a companion to another book, you know, because this word is fear, the old Scots word for companion and friend, and I like the idea that books could create their own companions, and that if you're, I mean, most writers in a sense anyway have a kind of a territory, if you like, or a ground, a plot of ground that you're interested in exploring, even if it's not conscious, that you might subconsciously return to again and again. And I don't think of my books as necessarily being single books. I think of the books as being, you know, hopefully I like the idea that people would read everything that I'd written. That's what I'd like, and be able to find some sort of conversation that was happening between the books themselves, so as the reading would become richer than just a single book. And that's what's to be hoped, really. So I like planting little things in different books for really active readers. And sometimes people notice things. You know, like, so I went to this little place in, what was it, Much Wenlock or something, and somebody had noticed that several of my stories have a character who's eating a scone with rhubarb and ginger jam. And so this woman came along with a home-baked jar of rhubarb and ginger jam. But it's really fun because I just do like little threads of things just for fun to see if anybody's paying any attention. But it's often funny when people think that you've done things that you haven't as well, because one time I attended a school that were studying the Adoption Papers in Bristol, and they said, we've noticed that you use cherry blossom a lot in your poems. Is this to do with the Japanese sign of regeneration? And I said, no, it's the only tree I know the name of. You know, a bit disappointed. And that day I'd forgotten my own book and I had to borrow the teacher's book. And there was all these wee notes down the side of the book, which is really fascinating. It's a bit like reading gossip about yourself. And I got to one of them and it said, punctuation seems all wrong. I read that out to the class and the teacher blushed a pleasing
eye. The other thing that I was struck by is your what seemed to me your feeling for narrative. So in both Red Dust Road and Fear, there's a sense in which narratives are woven rather than told. They don't seem... You seem almost a sort of reluctant to go from an A to Z, a sort of chronological narrative. There's a sense in which you're circling a narrative again and again. Of course, that's obviously really very clear in My Country, in that poem, which is a poem about circling. Mm-hmm. But there was a sense reading the poems alongside the Red Dust Road of this circling about narrative, a feeling of wanting to look at it from lots of different angles, a feeling of not wanting to put yourself in the middle of it, even though a memoir... I don't know whether that rings this bell.
No, I think that's exactly right. I think that's really perceptive. I think that's right. I think that's really what I try and do anyway, and that's nice that you've thought that. Mm-hmm. And use your name again for that.
That's twice.
twice. But I think that's really lovely because there is a sense of returning to something. Mm. Because I suppose you're not really... I don't really want to sort of look at something and then make a judgment about it and say, right, that this is how this is, this is how it exists, and this is how it must seem at this point. So it's particularly with memoir, I think, because it is an evolving form. I mean, my life is not finished. Touch wood, no, sorry. And it is evolving, it is going round and round. So you get to, and the people that I've written about are also still alive and still here, thankfully. And so there is a sense in which you write chapters, you circle chapters, but you have a sense that there are unwritten chapters. Mm. There are unwritten chapters in your life still to happen, which is quite an astonishing thing. And so that I think is very important when you're writing, that you don't just make a decision really, and that you have to examine something from every different angle. And also, I feel it's really important to try to be fair, because one of the terrifying things about writing a memoir is that you feel that you should try and be fair to everybody, because you're the one that's sitting in the driving seat, and no one else is sitting in the driving seat. So you feel that you have to present as many. I wanted to write a multi-voiced memoir that rather than just have my voice, but have the voices of all the people circling me.
And then those voices weave through into the poems, don't they? So you go at the poem like Upcore Market. The lovely poem which you also read about in the memoir, and yet again they sort of echo each other and enrich each other, I think, by reading them alongside.
Yeah,
I don't know whether that was in your... It's almost like the whole work is one piece, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's what I like, you know. I mean, maybe it's just a crafty marketing ploy, but no, I really like the idea that there would be a richness between the two things. Also because some things, it makes you actually ask why should something be a poem? And why should something be prose? As a reader, I don't mean that I'm going to give an answer to it, but it makes you ask the question as a reader, and I think that's really a nice question to be able to ask if you're interested in writing at all, or if you're interested in different forms. I don't know how many people here do write. How many people write poems? Yes, I've got quite a lot from all the wee noises. There's so many wee mms going on in different parts. So how many of you write poems? Keep your hands up, it was poems. Quite a lot. So how many write prose? Right, yeah, so much more poetry than prose. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm. And how many of you come here regularly?
Huh? I'd like to know that.
That's nice. Interesting. Well, how many have never been here before? Quite a lot. New converts, that's nice.
We will be having a mass wedding at the end.
Can I keep asking questions for ages more?
No.
Must I stop?
So the other thing I wanted to say about sort of trying to read the work, reading the work together, anyway, you've just touched on it, but it communicates to me this sort of sense of openness. a feeling for human relatedness, an unwillingness in a way to sort of pin things down once and for all. And I felt a certain sense of homelessness and being at home everywhere. Reading the Red Rooster, you go to Nigeria, there's a sense in which you're trying to be at home everywhere, and nowhere is the sense I felt reading it. And that echoes into the way you use language, the way you use different people's voices, the way you move from the world of Nigeria, the world of the highlands. It echoes through the love poetry in Darling and so on. Do you think that's right? I don't know if I've got a question, but that was...
Yeah, well, I think Red Dust Road is a book about landscape and about... It does ask that central question, where do I belong? But also for a reader, I'm hoping that the reader asks that question too of themselves, and that it is a book where the reader thinks about themselves in relation to place and landscape. I was really struck when I went to Nigeria of how much recognition I felt for that landscape, even though I'd never been there before, particularly when I found my father's ancestral village. It was just the most remarkable thing that I found at this Red Dust Road, which is why the book's called Red Dust Road, but I found that the Red Dust Road that I'd had in my imagination as a kid met the land of my bare feet. I mean, I felt like I had to take off my shoes and have my bare feet on that land, and I was really quite in love and fell in love with the landscape itself, and I found it quite extraordinary that you could have that kind of recognition for a landscape, almost a sense of knowing it without knowing it, almost a sense of, I even knew where to turn left, though I'd never been there, to my father's house. So it was very, very, very strange. But at the same time, nobody knew me and I was a complete secret, so nobody could be told about me. So I was, you know, there was his cousin, but she didn't know that I was of any relation. So I felt both, I felt a secret relationship to the landscape, but completely unknown myself. And so that mixture of being a secret and not being known with your own family, and then having relations with the land, is probably what gives me that feeling of feeling at home and both not at home. And also in Nigeria, I was in Ugpor, which is the ancestral village, and there's a lot of women whose faces exactly the same shape as me. And they were saying, Oibo, Oibo! And I thought they were saying, Ibo, Ibo! So I was saying, yes, my father is an Ibo. But then I found out that Oibo is a pidgin word for white women. I was a bit disappointed, really. And that was really kind of, that was strange, because, you know, I'd grown up with all the time with all of this kind of racist abuse and that. And then it really felt that for the first time in my life, I properly understood the meaning of the term mixed race, which isn't really a term that I particularly embraced, and I still don't particularly like. In fact, somebody in Edinburgh, I was doing a reading in Edinburgh recently, somebody asked me why didn't I like it, and I said, you know, why I didn't like it, and then this man put up his hand with quite a posh English accent in Edinburgh, and he said, may I suggest that because we're in Scotland, that you call yourself half and half? And I said to me, half and half, and half the audience got that joke and the other half didn't, because half and half is like a little half of beer and a little followed with a little whiskey chaser. Anyway, I'm like, I digress.
I mean, the other thing is, for me reading is that, you know, I really want to know how you got on with your brother since the Red Dust Road ends this incredible climax, doesn't it? Which I had to postpone going home so that I could go to a cafe to read it. Which, anyway, I won't go on about.
What did you tell people back home? Did you lie?
No, but I just sort of sheepishly went.
Really?
Anyway. So I was very struck by that story about meeting your brother at the end there, and I can't help but want to know whether you've met him since. And I also hear you've met your sisters since.
Yes, no, I have. In fact, one of my sisters is here, which is really, really great. And this is the first time she's ever come to a reading or heard me read.
Great.
I hope I haven't embarrassed you. but that was really amazing too, because when I'm talking about extra chapters, because Rani found me just by listening to a podcast on the net, and she worked out that the mother that I was writing about was also her mother, and so she got in touch with me, so she found me. So that has been the most extraordinary thing, and really, just really, really, really lovely. And it is like having this extra, just really extraordinary. So, and with my brother in Nigeria, you know, there's lots of things that have happened. Like the book, like you say, it stops at a certain place, and but life continues. And I don't know that I'll ever write the other bits that have happened after the after the life continuing. But it is interesting because my brother in Nigeria then went and confronted my father, who'd kept me secret all of these years, and he said, "On October the 2nd, I got a strange call from a strange woman. She says her name is Jackie Kay, and that you are her daughter. Can you confirm this, sir?" "How did she get your number? Never concern yourself with how she got her number. Can you confirm that you are her father?" "Maybe she's after her money." "No, she's not after her money."
And then I want to just finish with a sort of broader question, really. You know, Auden says famously that poetry makes nothing happen. You've been publishing poetry now for 20 years. You've been writing intensively for 20 years. You've been doing very, very many readings, amongst so much other things that you've been doing. What in your own words, in your own sense, is the function of poetry? And what does it do in the world? This is our trick question.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's probably a hard question. I think, you know, first of all, poetry is an intense way of thinking, and it's an intense way of using language, and so therefore it can actually open you out, and it can echo experiences that you've had. It can give you solace and comfort. It can help you when you're grieving, or it can help you understand intense emotions, whether you're in love or whether you've been rejected. There'll always be a poem that will find you and hold your hand through whatever deep experiences. If you're grieving, then a poem will be able to find a way to speak to you. So people at their most intense moments can turn to poetry and find something. But poems can also actually change the way that you look at yourself and at the world in general. And they can introduce you to whole new ways of thinking and whole new ways of culture, because they are idiomatic, and because they do use speech patterns and rhythms and repetitions and syntax, and because they use classical forms and modern free versing forms. There's all sorts of different ways of a poem actually, of you being able to return to that poem and put again and again and again, and for it to give you breath. I mean, earlier on you were telling us to be aware of our feet and our body and the weight. Well, a poem is really in a linguistic way a way of asking us to be aware, intensely aware of what's going on in the world, and at their most powerful, you know, you should have shivers down the back of your back, or shivers down the back of your hair, and you should almost have that feeling of a lift-off with a poem, you know, a surprise, a moment of recognition and a moment of complete surprise at the end of a poem where you think to yourself, gosh, you know, I didn't know I knew that. It almost brings you back to something that you didn't know you knew, but you did know all along. And so poems are so mysterious. I mean, I could talk about them for ages. You can't really make them happen. I mean, you can't bid them come here. They're less biddable than prose. I mean, you can't just, and but they're more portable than prose. So yeah, there's all sorts of different weird contradictions. You know, if you imagined poetry was a woman standing in your garden, and you sort of, you had French windows, if you had French windows, and you could open them, you wouldn't be able to get her to come in. I ask you, these are the powers that you should have as a lesbian poet. Yeah, so it's strange, it's a mysterious business.
Well, that seems a very, very good place to finish our interview.